Well, good morning, church. It's a gorgeous day. It's beautiful out. The sun is shining. My entire sermon is contained in one sheet of paper. You'll be happy to know. Be out of here quickly. You can beat the morning rush to... I don't know where you go. I don't have a life, so. Pastor Jin sends his greetings. He and his family are suffering on the Gulf Coast. I know. Hold him in your prayers during this difficult time. By way of introducing myself, I am Pastor Jim Bear Jacobs. I'm one of the incredible, sounds like I'm calling myself incredible. I'm one of the many incredible pastors on staff here, and yes, I guess I just did call myself incredible. But before I begin my sermon, I think it's very important to socially locate myself. I'm a Native American, a citizen of the Mohican Nation. Within that nation, I'm a member of the Turtle Clan. As a Native American, I have faced racism and oppression, instances that are too numerous to mention. I also locate myself as a cisgendered heterosexual male with light skin. And that social location has afforded me privileges and benefits that are also too numerous to mention. I have had an incredible journey for about the last 12 months. You see, in addition to being an incredible pastor, I'm also a bit of a social organizer, community activist, public speaker. I help plan events for various communities. And over the last 12 months, I have had the opportunity to be a part of creating beautiful events, opening spaces, in which I have been a minority as a cisgendered heterosexual male. I have sat in spaces with some of the most powerful, resilient, and incredible women that I have ever had the privilege of knowing. And over the last 12 months, there's been probably four or five of these events. One was the Protecting the Life Givers event, in which myself and others helped bring forth the voices of Native and Indigenous women. And we invited multitudes to come, sit, and listen to the wisdom that comes from our Native grandmothers, mothers, and sisters. In February, I was part of the Bartimaeus Kinsler Institute and their week-long conference on Indigenous land, law, and justice. And in the middle of this conference, I had the opportunity to enter into a sacred space in which five Indigenous elder women sat in a circle with some 120 people surrounding them. And these five women carried on a conversation in which none of us, as observers, were invited to join in. These women shared stories of strength, a resilience of overcoming. They shared stories of pain. They shared stories of oppression. In in that space, I felt a divine presence like I never have before. Most recently, I felt that same divine presence 2 weeks ago here in this sanctuary for our Gifts of Matriarchy service, in which Elder Nancy Allen beautifully guided us through a message of a sacred solidarity held by the women not only of this community, but globally as women. As I sat in the back, my heart began to break a little as Felice came forward to give honor to the elders in the room, but also to open up space for healing and prayer. And I watched as first women began to move forward to receive this prayer of healing. And then slowly, one by one, the men of our congregation followed suit to come and receive the healing blessing of strong, competent, resilient women. And all of these moments, all of these times in which I have had the incredible opportunity to be blessed, to sit within and surrounded by this divine feminine presence, it led me to think, where did we go wrong? Where did we go wrong? Why does a circle of indigenous female elders contain stories of pain and anguish? Why does a Gifts of Matriarchy service have to include a time to heal women? Where did we go wrong? Any good linear-minded Western engineer will tell you that to find the source of the problem, you have to go back to the beginning. So let's go back to the beginning. If you were to take a survey of Christians who are meeting this very morning, anywhere across this country, and you were to ask them one simple question, tell me your creation story, you know where they're going to start. Page one. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth was void and formless. And the Spirit of the Lord hovered over the waters of the deep. And then God spoke, let there be light, and there was light. We're all familiar with this story. It's what we have embedded into our spirits as our origins, as Christians. And it's a great story. It's a powerful story. It's poetic. It's easily memorable. And it establishes the divine power and authority of God. There's a problem. In my mind, it's not the actual beginning of our story. You see, what we cannot glean from just a cursory glance of the text is that this story in and of itself has an immense historical context to it. We love this story, especially us men. We love this story because this story, this Genesis 1, is dripping with testosterone. It is just embedded in masculinity. In Genesis 1, we have a God who simply speaks and things happen. What father would not love that power? But you see, Genesis 1 has a historical context. It's a story that comes out of the Babylonian occupation and exile. It's a story that is born under the oppression of imperial rule. And in the context of Babylonian exile, as you are surrounded with your oppressors, you inevitably rub up against their stories, their beliefs, their ideologies. And in the Babylonian pantheon of gods, you have gods who are represented by animal sculptures. You have a god who rides across the sky in his chariot of fire, the sun. And it only makes sense that under such oppression, as your ideology, your belief, your story rubs up against that of your oppressors, that you would create a counter-narrative. Genesis 1 says, okay, Babylonian oppressors, you worship deities that are represented in the shapes and forms of animals. Well, guess what? Our God simply said a word, and those animals came into existence. Your belief system holds that a deity rides across the sky in a chariot of fire, the sun. Guess what? Our God created light 2 days before he created the sun. Our God is more powerful than your God. Genesis 1 is an incredibly powerful story, but if I may be so crass as to suggest, it amounts to little more than a theological spitting match. Do you understand what a spitting match is? Some of you uncivilized folks may not, or I'm sorry, some of you civilized folks may not really understand what it is, but a spitting match is when junior high boys line up on the playground and they all stand in a straight line and they have a contest to see who can spit the farthest. And the one that spits the farthest wins. It's the epitome of adolescent masculinity. I've won a number. Genesis 1 is a powerful story, but it's not our origin. It's not our true beginning. In order to get at our true beginning, we need to turn the page. We need to look at Genesis 2. And Genesis 2, I suggest, is the indigenous story of creation. It is our actual story. Genesis 2 takes place at least 900 years before Genesis 1. It's older. Genesis 2 also reads, if you're familiar with sitting with native people, with indigenous people globally, Genesis 2 just reads like you're sitting around the fire while grandma tells a story. You see, in Genesis 2, the creator literally gets their hands dirty in the work of creation. Molding, shaping, hands in the dirt. Can there be a more matriarchal image? As cultures around the world will attest that generally the work of tending to the earth and producing good things from the earth is the tender work of women with dirt under their fingernails, up to their elbows in the clay. In Genesis 2, the Creator reaches down to the body of the earth and pulls humanity from the body of the earth. In Genesis 2, the Creator then bends down, places their lips over the nostrils of the created, and breathes the breath of life into it. This is the story of our beginnings. And I'm going to submit to you that Genesis 2, in contrast to Genesis 1, which is permeated with testosterone, in Genesis 2, testosterone, masculinity, patriarchy is absent. You see, if we read Genesis 2 not through the lens of white male theological masters who have given us the history of interpretation, not through the lens of preachers who have spoken on this text, which have been predominantly men, but if we read Genesis 2 through the lens of indigenous storytellers, a very beautiful picture emerges. Because see, in Genesis 2, we have the Creator as they literally reach down to the body of the earth and pull life from it. I have 4 children. My youngest, Judah, he's turning 6 tomorrow. When Judah was born, we used a midwife. She was incredible in every aspect, totally prepared for any situation that might arise, except she had one flaw. At the critical moment, parents, you know what I mean by critical moment. At the critical moment, this midwife, Rachel, she steps aside and she says, "Get in there, Dad, you're up." This was a stupid thing to do. But at that moment, these hands reach down to the body of my wife. And I very literally pulled life from her body. In Genesis 2, we see the loving hands of Creator reach down to the body of the earth as she births forth life into existence. In Genesis 2, we have this unique imagery that says the Creator reaches down and breathes into the nostrils the breath of life. The nostrils. That's the language. That's the specific word. Nostrils. You ever wondered about that? Why nostrils? I mean, nostrils are not one of those dignified parts of the body that people like to think about. And I've said nostrils now about 10 times, and now none of you can stop thinking about your own nostrils. Some of you are even, you know, doing one of these just to make sure. Why would you breathe into the nostrils? Now, we all know, even if you haven't taken any kind of first aid or CPR class, I mean, let's say Pastor John Nelson suddenly falls over unconscious on the floor. He's not breathing. Now, because we're all good Presbyterians, we're going to hold a meeting, have a vote. But eventually, I have confidence that we'll arrive at the decision that we want to revive him. And we know that the best way to introduce oxygen into a body that doesn't have it is mouth to mouth. Did our ancestors not know that? Did they not grasp the concept that this is much more efficient than that? No, they knew. So why, if you're breathing life into someone, would you use the nostrils? When one of my children were born, and I confess I have so many that I forgot which one, but one of them was born, and the attendant grabbed one of these little suction ball sterilized rubber things to clear the airway. And I learned that sometimes babies are born with the mucus plugs still in their nostrils. Now, these mucus plugs are an in-utero protection. It keeps bad things out from the very sensitive nasal cavities while they're in the uterus. And generally, the passage through the birth canal squeezes them out, and nobody knows that they were ever even there. But occasionally, every so often, a baby is born and the mucus plugs have not been expelled, but they're still there. And the attendants grab a sterilized rubber suction device and clear the nostrils. But what happened before we had sterilized rubber suction devices? In the practice of midwifery, as it has been executed really up into the early 20th century, when a baby was born with mucus plugs still in the nostrils, the midwife quite literally would bend down, place her lips over the nostrils of the baby, and suck them out and spit them to the side. Quite literally breathing the breath of life into the nostrils. Genesis 2 is not a creation story in the sense that we, as Western colonized and colonizers, think of creation. Genesis 2 is a birth story in which the Creator, she literally midwifes us into being. The clues are everywhere in the story. Even the name given to that first being, Adama, of the earth, quite literally translated in a modern Hebrew context, it means red, red with the clay, red like a newborn baby fresh from the womb. Red. Adama. The Creator, Genesis 2, is not the supremely masculine Creator. The Creator in Genesis 2 is a gentle, tender, loving grandmother who brings us into existence. Now we have to ask ourselves, what would our world look like if our entrance into this world was not through the booming patriarchal voice from the heavens, but rather through the intimate, loving embrace of a grandmother? What would that circle of indigenous grandmothers look like? Would I be sitting off in the distance, holding back tears as I listen to their stories of pain at the hands of others? What would our gifts of matriarchy service here at Church of All Nations look like if we were brought into the world not by a disembodied voice, but by a fully bodied grandmother? Would we feel the Would there even be a need to open up the space so women could come forward to receive a healing from situations, events, systems that they navigate every day? We celebrated this last election cycle because of the number of women who came forth to run for Congress and who won. Should we celebrate? Right now, 23.7% of Congress is female. 51% of the American population is female. And we are celebrating that less than 24% hold seats of power. Less than 5% of the Fortune 500 CEOs are female. Twelve and a half years ago, I held in my hands my firstborn child, a daughter. And I distinctly remember a moment as I'm sitting with this brand new baby in my hands, and saying to her, I will not let anything stop you. I thought I became a feminist. I had a daughter. I wanted the world for her. Didn't want anything to stop her. Now, I question. I don't question my commitment to seeing the advancement of women. I question whether or not I can even call myself a feminist. You see, my social location affords me privileges and benefits that I don't deserve. But I fully, consciously and unconsciously, take advantage of those benefits. And I wonder if I can even call myself a feminist, because so much of my comfortable existence is wrapped up in this patriarchal system which actively silences and oppresses women. It is in the same vein as my activism in racial justice, I would say, I don't know that white people can say that they're not racist. I don't know that I can say that I'm feminist, because too much of my existence is wrapped up in very unfeminist systems. So what are we to do? Jesus, at the pool of Bethsaida, came across a man who had been an invalid for 38 years. And this pool was a source of healing. We don't know much about this pool of Bethsaida. Undoubtedly, it was a natural spring, perhaps influenced by some geothermic forces that occasionally would trouble the waters, would stir up and bubble the waters, probably filled with very essential minerals that, when submerged into the water, would benefit your health. And the scene that Jesus comes upon is a scene in which people are waiting for the waters to be troubled. And then they jump over each other to be the one to receive the healing benefit. And this man could not bring himself down into the pool. Having been in that condition for 38 years, he certainly didn't have any money to pay someone else to bring him down into the pool. Jesus graciously offers his healing, but then he says, "Rise, take up your mat, walk." And in so doing, Jesus instructs this man, move out into the world. Be a testimony of your healing. Be a witness of this gospel, this good news. Do not stay here. Move out into the world. Show yourself to others. Church, men, the waters have been troubled by the hands of courageous, resilient women. We saw that as recently as 2 weeks ago from this very pulpit. We have been baptized into those healing waters. It is now time for us as men to rise up, take our mats, and actively move out into the world as a testimony to this healing. By moving out into the world, that man who laid invalid for 38 years, in ways that he was not even conscious of, began to break down the systems, the capitalist system that surrounded the pool of Bethesda, which meant that the most able-bodied, the most wealthy, the most privileged could receive the healings, while those who desperately needed could not. We've been baptized into those healing waters. It is now time for us to take up our mats, move out into the world, and undo the systems that have led us to where we are. There is no other path forward. We sit in a crisis. Everything that is feminine in our world is under attack. The earth herself, the most precious relative we have, the giver of life for all of us. We are years away, just mere years away from a critical tipping point from which we won't recover. She's under attack. We see the attack on the autonomy of women's bodies in places like the Mississippi and Alabama Senate. In Alabama, 25 white men dictated what a woman can do with her body and not do. Men who have never been pregnant, who have never held life in their bodies, who will never be pregnant, who have no right to speak on such things. And it's ridiculous. I mean, Pat Robertson came out and said that the Alabama bill went too far. When Pat Robertson says that you went too far to the right, there's something seriously wrong with you. If you don't know who Pat Robertson is, you don't want to. It's fine. I stand here and I admit that I don't know the best path forward for our healing. Throughout my lifetime, I have stood under the direction and sat under the guidance of incredibly godly men. And I'm the lesser for it. Because they don't know the path forward for our healing. More recently in my lifetime, I have had the benefit to sit with the sacred, the grandmothers, the mothers, the sisters, to sit in silence and watch as they gently lead and guide us into healing. Men, the waters have been troubled. Let us take up our mats and walk. Walk into that healing. Walk into that presence. Walk into those spaces where our voices are meaningless and powerless. Let us sit at the feet of the sacred as she leads us into our healing. Amen.